Tuesday morning at 9.
On 198 Longwave Now and DAB Digital Radio, the Daily Service led by the Reverend Dr. Mark Wakelin. Here on Radio 4 FM, our Book of the Week. The story of Karl Marx's daughter continues as Tracy Ann Oberon reads from Eleanor Marx, A Life by Rachel Holmes. Today, 16-year-old Eleanor, known as Tosi to her family, is off to France with Jenny Chen to join their sister Laura. However, it is 1871 and the French government has recently signed an armistice with the newly proclaimed German Empire. This tipping point has led France's citizens to organise themselves into communes, most notably in Paris.
The heroic and doomed Paris Commune of March to May 1871 was the first political event in which Tosi was personally involved. Alarming news came from Tosi's sister Laura in Bordeaux in March 1871. Her baby, Marc Laurent, born in February, was gravely ill, and her husband, Paul Lafargue, had gone missing. Paul had gone to Paris to request authority to organise the Revolutionary Army in Bordeaux and had not been heard from since. In the meantime, Schnappi, their elder son, had also become ill. Jenny Chen announced she was going to go and help. Inspired by her elder sister, Tosi said she was going too. April 1871 was the high point of the Paris Commune when the sisters travelled by steamer from Liverpool. On their arrival in Bordeaux, they went by the name of Williams in an attempt to conceal their true identities. They found Paul safely returned, but the children very ill. News from Paris was ominous. Reports reached them of the atrocities of Bloody Week, during which 20,000 communards and suspected sympathisers were executed. By the end of May 1871, the commune had been overpowered, and Paul was a wanted man. It hadn't yet occurred to the sisters that they might also be in danger. Their father sent an urgent coded letter telling them to get Paul and the children immediately to the Spanish side of the Pyrenees. They quickly started preparations for a discreet pre-dawn flight to the small resort town of Bagnères-de-Luchon. But the baby became sicker during the night, and Paul and Laura refused to make the journey until he improved. But he did not, and Marc Laurent died on the 26th of July. Then news came that government spies were closing in on Paul. The sisters persuaded him to leave straight away for Spain whilst they buried the baby. A week later, on the 6th of August, the three sisters and Schnappi made the journey over the border so that the Lafargue family could be safe together with Paul in the Spanish Pyrenees. To cover their tracks, Jenny Chen and Tosi made the journey on foot back into France the same day. The instant they put their feet back on French territory, armed police seized them. The furious sisters were delivered directly to the front door of the police chief, Émile de Keratry. Keratry had been police president of Paris the previous year and knew the Marxes and the First International all too well. He wanted to interrogate the sisters personally and made them wait under armed guard outside his residence until he returned from a summer concert in the park. When Keratry finally arrived, the sisters were separated, and Jenny Chen interrogated first. At midnight, it was Tosi's turn. Their ordeal continued a further 2 days. They were placed under house arrest in the Lafargue's abandoned lodgings. The apartment was in chaos, having been searched and turned upside down. Poking through their mattresses, the police asked the sisters where the bomb-making equipment was hidden. "They saw the lamps," Tosi wrote, "in which we had warmed the milk for the poor little baby who died, and thought they were filled with petrol." It is easy to have some sympathy with the police on this point. Meeting the sisters in person tended to confirm, not allay, their reputation among conservatives of being dangerous pétroleuses, the legendary women street fighters of the Paris Commune. Back in Bordeaux, further searches and interrogation revealed nothing. After a week, they were suddenly ordered to pack up immediately, shoved in a carriage, and shooed over the Spanish border. The sisters had won the game. Since their arrest, Jenny Chen had successfully concealed an incriminating letter to Marx and Lafargue from Gustave Florent, a famed leader of the Paris Commune. Florent, who had been captured by gendarmes and butchered during Bloody Week, was one of Karl Marx's oldest friends. Undetected by all, Jenny Chen slipped the letter from her sleeve into a ledger on the booking officer's desk when they were brought into the gendarmerie. While the agents searched their apartment, the letter remained safely hidden in plain view. As Engels observed, if discovered, this incendiary letter would have provided a sure passport for the two girls to be deported to New Caledonia. The Paris Commune was a brave, failed attempt at a proletarian revolution. The ripples lasted far, far longer than the event itself. It also strongly affected Tussie's choice of her first lover. Tussie helped with the organisation of the International Working Men's Association Congress in September. The Congress buzzed with reports and gossip about missing communards, shot, deported, exiled, or disappeared. Tussie had the official role of coordinating the Relief Committee for Communard Refugees. Her mother described Tussie's development at this time as eine Politikerin von top to bottom, a politician from top to bottom. She identified this as the point at which her youngest daughter emerged into adulthood. She was Eleanor, with a public political identity, no longer Tussie, the family tearaway. Exiled communard refugees starved on the streets of London. English mainstream press opinion was hostile to the political exiles. Eleanor later recalled, "It was proposed, quite seriously, that the communards who had taken refuge in England should be handed over to the doctors and hospitals for purposes of vivisection. Saddest of all is the fact that the workers were as bitterly hostile to the commune as their exploiters." Eleanor experienced this firsthand when she organised the first anniversary meeting to commemorate the Commune at a hall in Upper Regent Street in London. The communards and their English supporters arrived at the venue to find it barricaded against them and the landlord demanding the return of his deposit. So instead, they adjourned to the Cercle d'Etudes on Tottenham Court Road. This was the very moment that Hippolyte Prosper Olivier Lissagaray strode into Eleanor's life. As the party walked together towards Tottenham Court Road, Eleanor talked easily with the legendary communard. Whilst Eleanor was in Bordeaux during Bloody Week, Lissagaray had been fighting on the barricades, defending Paris from the Versailles army. Prosper Lissagaray fought single-handedly on the last manned barricade of the Commune, until he ran out of ammunition. With a death sentence on his head, he escaped from Paris and made his way to London. Lissa, as Eleanor called him, was a Basque from southwest France. A journalist and activist turned street fighter, he was 17 years older than 17-year-old Eleanor. Dashing and flamboyant, experience of extremity had made him also gentle-mannered and good-humoured. The attraction was instant and mutual. Physically striking, with her father's flashing coal-black eyes, Eleanor was elemental and mercurial, far from the gauze and velvet of vapid romantic love. She was unlike any other woman Lisa had yet met. Marx admired Lisa for his thinking and politics, but he didn't like his attentions to Eleanor. He had no intention of allowing his favourite to throw away her life. A titanic clash between father and daughter was brewing. In an attempt to quell the tension, Marx took Eleanor to Brighton for a fortnight. However, less than a week later, Marx came home alone, with a face like thunder. The previous day, Eleanor had informed her father that she had decided to stay in Brighton and earn her own living. The ensuing 24-hour row failed to alter her decision. Mark sulked in his study and wrote complaining letters to Engels about the confounded Le Sagaré. Eleanor, meanwhile, set herself up in private lodgings near the seafront and signed up with an employment agency. It was no small thing in early 1870s England for a young woman without her own money or formal education to strike an act of independence like this. Eleanor did not want to continue living off the bounty of Engels. She knew her parents depended on him for the mainstay of their annual income and that her sisters relied on his financial support. Early in May, the employment agency found her a teaching post at a seminary for young ladies in Sussex Square. For the first time, mistress of her own routine, carrying her own salary in her purse, Eleanor was challenged and exhilarated. Lissa caught the train from London and visited her regularly at the weekends. They took long walks, arm in arm along the seafront, munching fish and chips and chain-smoking. Eleanor was, in her mother's view, working too much and eating too little. But what tipped Jenny's anxiety was her discovery that in Brighton, Lissa seemed to be accepted by all as Eleanor's betrothed, allowing the couple free rein to wander around unchaperoned. Under pressure from both parents, Eleanor became stressed and anorexic. Reluctantly, she gave up her teaching job and returned home in September, deeply disappointed, extremely thin, and in a state of nervous collapse. Her father had got his secretary back, but she was resentful at her return. Eleanor, confronted with her secret engagement to Lissa, was forbidden from seeing him at all. She put up a spirited resistance to her father's possessiveness, but she had inherited his propensity for stretches of intense productivity, punctuated by stress-related exhaustion. This was the great age of nervous anxiety and feverish repression, labelled hysteria. Eleanor contracted the whole infuriating syndrome, brilliantly depicted by Wilkie Collins, as the effects of patriarchal repression and thwarted desire on intelligent, ambitious daughters. Fainting and anemic, Eleanor was torn between her father, her lover, and her independence. In March 1874, she wrote to her father, "I want to know, dear Moore, when I may see El again. It is so very hard never to see him. I have been doing my best to be patient. I am beginning to feel so very miserable." The great Elizabeth Garrett Anderson was now Eleanor's doctor. Garrett Anderson was the first woman to qualify in England, appearing on the medical register for the first time in 1866. Garrett Anderson did a great deal to restore Eleanor to her robust self by the end of 1874. She focused primarily on Eleanor's need to eat and build up her strength. With firm diplomacy, she also focused on Eleanor's need for occupation. Garrett Anderson sensed how Marx had unintentionally thwarted her youthful ambition and desires, but judiciously withheld comment. She encouraged the whole family to build up Eleanor's appetite, which improved in geometric proportions, according to her delighted father. For a few years, Eleanor's life had resembled that of the thwarted heroine of a Collins novel. Now she was beginning to break the mould. She stopped asking for permission to continue with her liaison with Lissa and simply re-established the relationship in the open. Coming of age, in the epoch of the Commune, encountering all its challenges and contradictions, Eleanor was presented with alternative versions of femininity and the possibilities of the life of a woman.
Tracy Ann Uberman continues reading from Eleanor Marx, A Life by Rachel Holmes, at the same time tomorrow. The abridger was Julian Wilkinson and the producer was Elizabeth Allard. Jane Garvey talks to Kirsty Walk about her new documentary, which looks at whether offensive sexism and misogyny is on the rise, plus a discussion with Professor Nazeen Rahman, pioneer in the field of clinical genetics. We hear about the potential benefits of testing for women with breast and ovarian cancers. Women's Hour coming up after the news here on BBC Radio 4.